It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. If you've been lusting after some $300 coffee maker that's touted as making coffee for the gods, lust no more. Evidently, the perfect cup lies not in a chunk of change, but in how you twist your wrist. Now, this is from the brains of the man behind Sweet Maria's. This guy has made coffee his life. Now, be careful, because this is one of those discussions that can take you from curious to driven. So DIY rides today with building your own bread oven, brewing that good cup, and making new summer fruit desserts. That's this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's all hands-on today. A sculptor has us building a backyard bread oven. A self-proclaimed coffee geek has the how and the surprising why of brewing the ideal cup. And our road food duo, Jane and Michael Stern, are on Lake Superior with a local specialty that might not sweep the country. More from them in a bit, but let's get started with our friend and comrade in food obsession, John Willoughby. John, good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
John, you did a piece on dried limes. What the heck do you do with dried limes? No, because they are the funkiest looking things.
Aren't they? I mean, for years and years, I just walked right past them because they look like little weird rocks, you know, slightly larger than ping pong balls. Sometimes they're black, but usually there's this kind of dusty brown.
Yeah,
And then you pick them up and they don't weigh anything. They're like just this like little piece of giant fluff. So I just put them back down and walked away. But then a couple of years ago, somebody recommended that I try them, and I started using them. And they actually are one of those wonderful ingredients that just enlivens your cooking, and you keep finding more and more ways to use them.
Mm-hmm.
They're used traditionally in soups and stews, and that is a great way to use them. I mean, it's very easy. You just take the dried limes, you put three or four in a big pot of stew, and you just put a few holes in them with a fork or a sharp knife and just put them in there when you start cooking, and the liquids of the stew or the soup just keep coursing through them, and they add this amazing flavor. And it's hard to describe in words, because if you crack them open, they're black inside with a little sort of a red tinge.
Huh.
So they look totally weird. But what happens is they make them in the Middle East, in the Gulf states, and take these small limes they have over there, boil them for a little bit of time in salt water, and then put them out in the desert sun to dry over a few weeks. And as they dry, you know, those kinds of processes create really complex flavors. So they still have some of that sour citrus flavor of limes, which is good enough to begin with.
Right.
But then they've got a little sweetness and this very kind of funky sort of fermented flavor. And the best way I can think of to describe them is it's like you're chewing on lime rind while you're walking past a brewery. So it's this very complex and interesting flavor. So put them in a soup or a stew, and in the end, it's one of those ingredients a little bit like fish sauce. You can taste it, but it's really just deepening and enriching the flavor of the stews.
Can you grind these things up?
You do. They use them powdered in the Middle East also, and often they just add them to stews. But in the Gulf states, they use them in spice mixes. So you can buy them ground, but like all spices, it's better to do it yourself. And you just cut them open, take a serrated knife and cut them open, because you have to take out the seeds. And then that's it. You put them in a clean coffee grinder and grind them up to a fine powder. And that way, they're great. I like to actually just put them on a steak or a pork chop before you put them on the grill, just a little bit of that powder.
Wow.
It's a little astringent, so you need something with some fat in it.
Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, mix it with some cumin, coriander, salt and pepper, a little cinnamon. It's
what
an amazing spice rub. And it's great for seafood, shrimp or any kind of fish. Just rub a little bit on there, put it on the grill. Tastes great.
How about putting them in salad dressing? In so many words, what about using them not cooked, that ground up lime?
Yeah, it's totally fine. I think, you know, just use a little pinch of it in a vinaigrette. You know, Lynn, that's a brilliant idea, which I never thought of, but I bet it tastes fantastic.
Well, you have to understand, it's the time of year where the idea of even a flame on a grill you know, is too much. I break out into, shall we say, glow at the thought of any form of heat.
Well, I have a really great dried lime recipe for you then, because it also makes a great tea, which is a wonderful iced tea, because it's sort of a cross between a regular tea and a limeade. So it's got that deep sort of tea flavor, but it's also got the brightness of limeade. It's a great summer drink, and it couldn't be easier. You take four of these dried limes, you sort of crush them up, you know, with a mortar and pestle, put them with a couple of cups of water. Or 4 cups of water for 2 limes is probably about right. Mm-hmm. And then you just boil it for 5 minutes, strain it so you get out the lime. Then you add 1/4 cup of sugar, mix it up, and you've got this great iced tea.
Whoa. Oh, that's fabulous.
And if you feel like it, you can put a little rum in it, too.
Better. Even better. John,
this is
brilliant. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Willoughby's article on dried limes was in the May 31st, 2010 issue of the New York Times. Imagine that lime tea right now, chilled, tart. Well, you can have it. You'll find the recipe, splendidtable.org. Mexico or Europe, keep your eyes open for bread ovens. They're usually dome-shaped, and they used to be the center of socializing and cooking for entire towns. That artisan bread that we like so much, well, this is the oven you need to do it right. Well, the good news is you can make one yourself. Sculptor Kiko Denzer travels the country showing schools and communities how to build their own ovens. Kiko, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn. It's nice to be here.
Could you walk us through the basics of building an oven?
Sure. The best way to start is to sort of go through the history of ovens and fire, because, of course, you know, the first thing people did was they just built a fire and put bread in the coals.
Mm-hmm.
But the history of ovens is basically a hot fire and a flat rock to basically a little hole in the ground. So the best first step is to just take a few bricks, make a pile of sand on the bricks, and then cover the sand with mud, cut a hole in the dome that you make, and put a fire in it, and let it get hot. And then once it's hot, you can put in a little focaccia or a little pizza or some cookies or whatever. And you can literally make one of those in a half an hour, and you don't need a book, and you don't need anything special, and you can do it with your kids, and they'll get all excited just to make cookies in their own little oven. But once you've done that, it won't hold heat very long, and you can't cook a lot in it. Mm-hmm. So you build a little bit bigger one. And then you can keep a little fire in the side if you want to cook pizza, or it'll hold enough heat to cook some bread or a chicken or whatever else you have. But again, you know, after a while, you realize either it's not big enough or it doesn't hold heat long enough, and then you're ready to make a larger commitment, so you build a foundation to get it up off the ground.
Now, I'm just trying to picture this. First of all, I want to just go back to the beginning. When you make that mound of sand and then you put mud over it, that mound of sand is just to help the mud dry into a hollow shape, right? And then you pull the sand out.
Right, that's the mold.
Right, it's that's the mold. And that, no matter what your oven is, that's where you always begin, is with the mold.
Right. It's the shape of the void.
Right.
So then, Lynn, once you've played around with your little ovens and you're confident about your materials, then you can go ahead and build your deluxe model, which, of course, you want to raise up to a good working height, which is usually about waist high. So then you build a platform. And the platform can be, you know, anything from a couple of stout sawhorses to a stack of logs to railroad ties, you know, a super fancy, beautiful brick or stone. And then you have a plinth and you build your oven on top of that. So you put your layer of insulation down, right, because you want to isolate the masonry so it holds heat. You build the oven on top of that layer of insulation, and then you wrap it with more insulation, which is just, it's basically the same material, except that instead of mixing it with sand, you mix it with sawdust or straw or anything lightweight. and then you put a finish plaster on it. And that's your basic oven. And that in itself is a beautiful sculpture. It's just, you know, the shape is lovely and round. It's like half of an egg. But if you want to make a sculpture, you know, if you want a fire-breathing dragon or a a duck or a face or whatever, you can sculpt onto it whenever you're inspired. You know, once you've finished the basic oven, you don't have to do it all right away. You can do it in phases. And then you've got your full-size oven, and you can cook anything in it that you want. After you've done your pizza and flatbread and sourdough breads, which all need high temperatures, then as the heat declines, you can cook meat, fish, vegetables, soup, stew, stock. You can incubate your yogurt. You can dry your shoes.
Do anything you want,
right? Yeah. Then when you're done with your cooking, there will still be residual heat in the oven. And the best way to use the oven is to make sure you use all the heat, right? Because
right,
if you've burnt all that wood and stored all the heat in the oven, you want to get the most out of it. So at the end, what we do is we stuff our oven full of wood for the next firing, because even dry wood will hold 10 or 15% moisture, depending on where you are. And the more of that moisture you can drive out before you go and fire your oven the next time, the faster and hotter it will heat.
I have a feeling that we're going to see a spate of ovens going up in my neighborhood.
Well, my hope is that the neighborhood will rally around the ovens they built. You know, it's not an oven for every house. It's an oven for every neighborhood because
yes,
it, you know,
yeah,
it is a community hearth. And that's, I think, the greatest value.
Hey, Kiko, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Lynn.
Sculptor Kiko Denzer is co-author of Build Your Own Earth Oven. Now, get some friends. Give it a try. I mean, he claims you can do a full-scale oven in a weekend, and then you can christen it with Kiko's simple sourdough bread. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, once you've got that bread, homemade or not, let some go stale, and then you're set for Mediterranean classic. This is my annual lecture on the bread salad. Now, this is sort of how you make something from nothing. Bread that might go to the birds and small amounts of different kinds of vegetables and seasonings. Here's the basic gist. You want one part stale bread to maybe two parts vegetables. You tear the bread into chunks, you moisten it with some water and vinegar, season it however you'd like, and then let it sit while you cut up the veggies. Tomatoes are sensational here, but the idea is nearly anything can go into it, including raisins and nuts. You dress the vegetables first to taste with oil and vinegar, and there's a neat trick to know about how to add spices to the salad. Always warm spices in the olive oil. Just warm them because it opens up their flavors. Okay, so all of that goes into a bowl. Now you squeeze out the bread. You toss that in. You taste it for seasoning. And you serve this up with maybe a white Albarino wine from Spain. And it's pretty swell. Coming up, brewing a beautiful cup of coffee and the sweets of summer. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, picture this. It's the mid-90s. A coffee lover, Tom Owen, moves to a place where coffee's not at its best. No problem. He knows how to roast his own. One hitch. Green, unroasted beans are only sold in huge batches. Tom gets a bright idea. Buy the huge batch, sell it off in small batches, and keep some for himself. Free coffee. And a one-time deal for Tom. Well, he failed at the one-time part. Today, his site, Sweet Maria's, is practically a cult among coffee fanatics. He's got a huge list of small batch beans for home roasting and two encyclopedias worth of coffee information. Tom Owen, it's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So how can we at home brew a great cup of coffee?
Well, in the past, in the United States, I think people have really been into electric drip brewers. But in the coffee houses, people have kind of regressed back from making coffee, a lot of coffee in a big urn that's like a cafeteria. It's like food that's sitting there waiting, and then you come and they serve it for you.
Right.
They've gone from that to making French presses of coffee, which is great. It's fresh. It's made just for you when you come in. But sometimes there's that grittiness and that last sip in the cup that has that sediment at the bottom that you can't really drink. And now, actually, a lot of coffee houses are using single pour-over by-the-cup brewing, one cup at a time in a little Melitta-type filter cone with a V-shaped paper filter in it. So that's a great way to make coffee at home, and people have been doing it for a long time that way. But there's some improvements lately in technique that get you some better results.
And what are they?
Well, first, if you've ever noticed, those Melittas have 3-4 holes on the bottom of them, and the water just drains right through the coffee into the cup immediately. It's better for coffee and water to steep for 4 minutes or so. That's the ideal.
Uh-huh.
One technique is called blooming, where you take a small amount of hot water, not even enough to drain through into the cup, and you just wet the grounds. And ideally, if the coffee's fresh, it will actually foam and bloom up, where the name comes from.
Right.
And then after that, you leave it for about 30 seconds, and that kind of opens up the pores of the ground coffee, and you can start pouring as slow as you can, ideally in a circular pattern.
Why in a circular pattern?
Well, because if you just pour it all in the center, it kind of upsets the grinds, and there's sort of a bed of grinds. It's like sediment.
I see what you mean. So you're not everything is going to be brewing at the same rate.
Right, right. So it's kind of a delicate thing to do it right. But you can make a single cup or two cups, pour over, and get really nice results.
So the idea is that you want that coffee to steep, so you have to figure out a way, and it's by adding the water slowly, to let it brew, to let it extract flavor.
Right, to keep the hot water and the coffee together for longer.
Okay.
That's correct.
So this is now just using that Melitta cone. That's it.
Right. Now, recently there have been some other types that have come out. There's different ceramic models. There's one called the Hario V60, which makes it sound like an engine or
really a rocket
high-tech
ship. Yeah, okay.
And it's very technique dependent. It's very hard to use. It's not expensive. It's like $12 or $15. But in Japan, where it comes from, they say it's required to buy these kettles that are at least $60.
What?
To have the correct pouring technique to use with the Hario V60. So I had made a little YouTube video that was a little bit critical of that.
Yeah.
So I had some comments on my video from Japan saying that there were currently graduate students writing their master's thesis on the Hario V60 and that I was mistaken about the design.
But let me ask you this. What about the electric drip machines that most of us have in our kitchens? Are they really not the way to go?
Well, there's just not many models that actually deliver really hot water, which is you want 195 to 205 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, at the brew head, dripping down into the coffee. They just don't have the power to do that. And we've always thought that maybe they slightly detune them because of lawsuits. You don't want coffee to brew as hot as it really should.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll measure them and they're 185, 180, and you just won't get a really brilliant, bright, sweet cup of coffee with that kind of water temperature.
Mm-hmm. What's your take of the mocha pot? You know, the one where you put the water in the bottom and then there's a chamber at the top and you put it over heat. And what happens is the coffee's in a basket between the water and the empty top and the water gets drawn through and then suddenly the coffee is in the top chamber.
Right. You know, I guess I'm a hypocrite because we sell them, but I don't really love them.
Why not?
I don't know. They're really beautiful. They look great on your countertop. And they call it stovetop espresso. And I think that brings up the fact that it's really not. And you can't really make espresso on your stovetop. One problem with it is that you want to keep the coffee grounds. You don't want to preheat them. You don't want to bake coffee before you brew it, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is it has the heat, but it doesn't have the pressure to really get something espresso-like out of the coffee. So if you like what you get from a mocha pot, then fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think it's sort of espresso, then probably not.
It's going to disappoint you.
Mm-hmm.
But you can buy the Melita cone for next to nothing, and you can use this pour-over technique, and you're home free.
Right. I think that's what I like to think about is how much effort do you have to put into coffee to get how much reward? Because people are busy. They don't have time to,
right,
you know, study Japanese pouring techniques on coffee. There is a neat new device called the Clever Coffee Dripper. And it is kind of clever. It's basically a Melita cone. Same thing, except it has a stopper in the bottom. And so like a French press where you have coffee and water in contact for 4 minutes, this basically keeps all the hot water as you pour it in,
right,
with the coffee. You can cover it. You just keep it on your counter. And then when it's time to brew at 4 minutes, you put it on a cup and it just drains down.
Oh, that sounds great. This is doable. I like this. Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
Tom Owen's coffee site is Sweet Maria's. Take a look and beware, addiction is just around the corner. Fruits, in an odd way, are very difficult. They carry this real sense of urgency. I mean, you want to stop time so that you can try them in all kinds of ways. Well, Deborah Madison is here with some ideas. Deborah, good to have you back.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
I know you get that same sense, don't you? That, you
know, oh, I do.
You know, give me another 3 weeks, please.
It's just with fruit as it is with tomatoes.
So what are the crucial things for you when you're choosing fruit and when you're cooking with it?
I think the most crucial thing of all to me is whether it has perfume. Now, obviously, in fall fruits, that's not going to be so important. But in summer fruits, in those plums and peaches, all the stone fruits, strawberries, raspberries, to me, perfume is crucial because perfume gives you the promise of what's to come. If it's there and it smells wonderful and enticing, you can be pretty sure that you're going to have a good tasting fruit.
Is there something to look for when you're buying fruit to get the most flavor?
I think that there are some signs. One I learned from a farmer, actually, had to do with nectarines. Because he had nectarines at the market. I picked them up. They were very, very hard. And I said, why should I buy your fruit as opposed to buying hard nectarines in the supermarket?
Yeah.
And he said, aha. He says, well, young lady, you need to trust the crust. And he explained to me that in the case of the nectarine, if the skin is dull looking, that even if it's hard, it's going to ripen successfully within maybe 3 or 4 days. If it's shiny, it's not going to happen. So this is something he probably learned by being a farmer and observing over and over again.
What about sunspots? I've heard about. They look like little tiny freckles.
Yeah, and he called them sugar spots, which is how I've heard. And
right,
they're that beautiful russeting that comes with those little tiny spots that cover a plum or a nectarine are often an indication of sweetness, which is why they're called sugar spots.
All right, this is the real bane, I think, because this is the time of year to make, you know, really simple fruit tarts, except the crust gets soggy.
Oh, yeah.
What's your... My approach is to pre-bake it, but that takes extra time.
I always pre-bake my crust, partly just to get that nice crisp texture, but it's not going to keep if you're making then a plum tart or you're baking peaches in it, because stone fruits especially have so much liquid in them. I don't know where it comes from. You put them in the oven and it just exudes,
yeah.
Which is why they're fun to saute, actually, because you get this beautiful sauce, but you
right.
don't want that sauce in your tart. So what I do is I always save like old biscottis or cookies or even breadcrumbs. They need something in the bottom that will absorb some of those juices, and a kind of a dry cookie like thing will do that job very nicely. You just sprinkle some over the crust and then add your fruit. And now it's not going to keep forever, obviously, but the juice has a place to go besides the crust or before it gets to the crust.
Yeah, and it tastes good too. I mean, you're putting stuff in there that really has nice flavor.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
And if you're
idea.
Using breadcrumbs and you saute them in just a little bit of butter or toss them in a little melted butter, that adds, of course, a nice little flavor too.
Yeah.
And crushed walnuts. I love crushed walnuts with plums. To me, walnuts and plums always seem very compatible together, so I often use those in combination.
That's a dynamite idea. Hey, Deborah, thank you.
Well, thank you, Lynn.
Deborah Madison's book is Seasonal Fruit Desserts from Orchard, Farm, and Market. Now, you can find her recipe for red berry soup with white peaches and summer berries on the website, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern find these local gems, the places you want to eat at when you're on the road instead of the places you settle for. Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So, latest discoveries?
We've been in northernmost Wisconsin. And, you know, there are many great things to eat in northernmost Wisconsin. I won't even get into cheese curds. But let's talk about whitefish, because, you know, that's where the whitefish comes from. From Lake Superior, and, you know, those cold, cold waters, I guess, is where it thrives. And, you know, to the rest of the country, whitefish is just some lake fish. And when you get into Wisconsin, Minnesota, I mean, it's really important and it's really delicious. And we found a restaurant in the town of Bayfield, which is right on the shore there, that specializes not only in whitefish, either on a plate or cooked on a plank, but also in whitefish livers, which you don't find too many places.
You know, fish livers just are not the kind of thing, you know, that are the daily special in a lot of places.
Yeah, and you notice Jane has not said a word about this.
Well, Jane is a liver lover, but mostly...
Yeah, but not fish liver. So Michael is going to do most of the talking. I will, however, say that Bayfield, Wisconsin, and that whole drive up to northernmost Wisconsin is one of the most beautiful areas I have ever seen in my life. Have you been there, Lynn?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's really like going to a New England village.
It really
yeah.
is. With
On, you know, a Midwest lake. It's a beautiful little town, and that whole area is gorgeous.
Oh, gorgeous. And the lake is steely blue, and I'm not sure I'd want to be there in the middle of January, but... You know, most of the spring, summer is absolutely perfect to go there. But getting back to livers,
let's
of
talk
fish.
About livers. Okay,
I now, can hardly wait.
Well, now, if you were a fisherman on the Great Lakes, you probably would know whitefish livers, because I think professional fishermen and even amateurs.
I don't think Lynn is a fisherman.
No, but if you were,
you
would know and appreciate them, because they have long been considered a kind of delicacy. But the fact is that it takes a lot of fish to get enough livers to make a meal. So they have not been a very popular restaurant dish. You need like maybe 15 or 20 of them to make a meal. But boy, are they good. They're almost nothing like beef liver or uh-huh. calf's liver. They are, like the white fish itself, very kind of fresh and bright tasting as opposed to meaty.
Maggie's, which is a little cafe, which in fact our friend Julie Zickafoos, who's a nature artist, was up there birding. She's a bird watcher, and she recommended it to us. Very Very simple little place. And
simple, but painted bright, bright pink.
Right, painted bright pink, very eclectic. And they don't serve anything frozen, so you won't see big cartons of frozen fish livers. If the fishmonger does not have them fresh, they do not appear on the menu. And they are a seasonal treat.
The same, by the way, is true of the whitefish itself, that if they cannot get the whitefish that day, they don't serve it.
But, guys, you've got to tell me how they make these little things.
Okay, the liver, they're rolled in spiced flour, and they're sautéed with peppers and onions and mushrooms. And so what you get is like little kind of maybe double bite-sized nuggets with a crunch, a little bit of a crisp crunch on the outside, and the inside is kind of velvety, almost creamy, very soft. And as I said, with a kind of bright flavor that's very unlike the liver that most of us are accustomed
and
to.
Can I just add something? They also have Maggie's Wisconsin Burger, which is a Dairyland tour de force topped with aged cheddar, Colby cheese, Amish blue cheese, and Swiss cheese, and you don't even have to think about a fish or its liver or any other organs within it.
Well, there's something for everyone. A little liver, a little cholesterol, you know, great cheese. Guys, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bet you're going fishing all of the time. Baby going fishing too. Bet your life, your sweet wife, catch more fish than you. Many fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing to play the blues.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is The Lexicon of Real American Food. Now, you can find out more about Maggie's and their other gems on the website. And you can find that you can sign up for our free seasonal e-newsletter, Griller's Chronicle. There are a couple of more weeks, and when you sign up, you're automatically registered to win a Griller's Goodie Box from Sur La Table. Now, I mean, this is a goodie box. Just take a look, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what disorder might a person obsessed with eating the right foods develop? Well, we're going to have that answer in a minute, and we're going to be talking with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so you can join us, 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what disorder might a person obsessed with eating the right foods develop? Well, apparently, there is a disorder called orthorexia. It is an excessive need to eat the right foods. Now, people who deny their fat when they are have, no surprise, fatorexia. Eatorexia is about those who are obsessed with sweets. And right now, I am getting into boredorexia. So, enough. To us any way you want. Call us, 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org, or check us out on Facebook. Okay, let's see. Who is up? We've got Nick calling from Omaha. Nick, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, sir.
So I'm a vegetarian.
Right.
And I have no patience for soy burgers. So
you're in very good company.
Yeah. And they're just too processed for me. So what I've been doing is like the portobello mushroom burgers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And every time I have them, though, they always just seem like there's something missing. Is there something I can do to like spice it up a little bit or make them a little more flavorful or interesting?
What are you doing with them now?
Right now I'm just putting either like a little butter or olive oil on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then putting like a little salt and pepper on them.
And grilling them.
And grilling them on aluminum foil.
Well, there's a recipe. It's from Italy. And it is essentially portobello mushrooms, or really it was originally done with porcini. But anyway, big mushrooms with holy oil. And holy oil was a tongue-in-cheek thing. And what it was is that you would take, a mini blender or whatever, and you would mix olive oil, garlic, a lot of it, salt and pepper, and hot chili. You know, dried little red chilies or whatever kind of chili you want. And you'd brush that on the mushroom and let it sit for a little while before you put it on the grill.
Okay.
And be generous with the brushing. And that you would grill into the mushroom. The other thing is you could do what's called a chermoula. This is a sauce and a marinade that comes from Morocco, and essentially it's a ton of fresh coriander. I, by the way, throw fresh mint in there too. Also garlic, also olive oil, a lot of lemon, cumin, for instance, goes into it, paprika, and then you could have hot chili in there if you wanted. But essentially, sweet paprika would be in there, if nothing else. And you puree that, and it should taste like a great dressing. And then what you would do is you'd put the mushrooms in that maybe for a half hour, and then just lift them out of it and grill them and have a fresh batch of it. And when you serve the mushrooms, have that sauce in a pitcher so people can pour it.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And that's the other thing. You could do your plain grilling the way you're doing it, but you could have table sauces and table spices waiting.
Okay.
You know, so you could do things like really piquant sauce might be something like the barbecue sauce you'd find in the Carolinas, which is vinegar, black pepper, and some hot pepper. Really tart. Or you could do fresh mint and do like a sweet sour. You'd puree mint with a little bit of brown sugar and lime. It would be fabulous on
that. Yeah, that sounds great.
You know, that just goes on fresh, and it's just delicious.
Okay. I've been using a gas grill. Would using a charcoal grill maybe add a little more flavor to it?
I think so. But the other thing is you could put some damp wood chips on that gas grill, you know, to smoke them a little.
Uh-huh.
And they could be any kind you want.
That sounds great.
So give it a shot. But the idea is really piquant sauces, and they're out there.
Oh, great.
Okay. Hey, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. You know, these are all sauces you can make in a blender and you can have waiting in the fridge for a week even. So they're there, you know, and anything you've got, just pour it on. 800-537-5252 or online, splendidtable.org. We've got Cindy calling from Scottsdale, Arizona. Cindy, hi. What's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, when I was growing up in Scottsdale in the 50s, my mother used to make a cold sour cream and cucumber salad during the summer.
Right.
And she called it something like shav. Her mom was Swedish, and my husband's parents are from Poland, also around the Baltic, and they made the same thing, although they called it something similar, my husband thinks, but he thinks mostly they called it salad. And apparently it's common in Russia, but it's also common and popular in the American South, I found out on Google. And they just call it sour cream and cucumber salad. I make it with cucumbers and radishes and maybe celery and tomatoes and things like that.
Yeah, it sounds delicious.
And you serve it really cold. It's really good and refreshing in the summer. But I'd love to know what the real name is for it and where it's really from.
Oh, I wish I had an answer for you. Let me tell you. This is one of those cases This happens within single countries, and it happens just as it has with this. The seemingly the same food, its name changes from country to country because language changes. But also, there'll be subtle differences in the dish from place to place, not just from country to country, but, you know, from area to area. And it's but I have a theory about this kind of thing because I grew up in the New York area, and there was such a stress on dairy in that environment. And I think part of it was because a really large percentage of the population was from Central Europe.
Yeah.
And from Eastern Europe. And dairy plays a really big role, and it plays a very significant role also in the Nordic countries. And it makes sense because these are countries where preserving dairy in some way, shape, or form would be important, and you'd have cooler weather to do that. And the idea of sour cream as the salad dressing for something like a cucumber, which already has such a lovely, clean, light quality to it, the sour cream would be the perfect complement. So I think it's part of an overall tradition of dairy used in cooking in ways that you don't see in the rest of the world. And I know that doesn't tell you the name of it because I don't think there probably is a true name for it, you know, a final name.
Have you ever heard of shav?
Oh, yes, I have. And I've had this kind of salad very often. I've had it when it's done with dill and onion and the cucumber, and I've had it similar to what you're describing. I've had it done where it was a little bit of sour cream, but there was white vinegar and sugar and water and then sour cream. And I've had it done even with, believe it or not, hot pepper in it, but I don't think that's necessarily traditional. Maybe it is.
Well, I add Cajun spices, but that's just me.
Yeah, and in Hungary, no doubt, somebody's adding some glorious paprika to it. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a case where you have these things available and everybody interprets it slightly differently. Yeah. And this is the fascinating thing about food. How it travels, how it changes from one place to another in very subtle ways. So you're eating a dish that is beloved by much of Eastern Europe and Northern Europe.
What would you call it?
I would call it a cucumber salad with sour cream.
Okay. Good enough.
And I think it's just dynamite. And I love your idea of doing it with the radishes and all the other things in it. I'm going to adopt that this summer.
Okay.
Hey, thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is fascinating stuff, by the way. This is where you get into culinary anthropology and you figure how dishes travel and you look at how dishes change on borders. Border areas are always great in terms of finding really interesting food because they're always blends. Anyway, you can reach us, splendidtable.org or 800-537-5252. Dave is calling from Austin, Texas. Dave, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call. I've just recently started listening to your show on KUT, and I love it a lot.
Well, thank you.
And my neighbor every year has a chili cook-off, and I'm thinking about entering it this year. And one of the categories is for a non-traditional chili. And so I've got this idea in my head that I'm needing a little help with to do an Indian-influenced chili, like a dal.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. You've done dal then, right?
I've done dals before, and I actually have a flavor for a fairly savory, spicy dal that actually uses I use jalapeno because they're on hand.
Yes.
But it also ends up being quite thick. And so I don't know if I should just sort of thin it down with tomato.
You could, but what's going to taste best? Because chilies can be thick, you know, and you could always use a little bit of water or a vegetable broth as well. It depends, but what's going to taste best, do you think? That's the key.
Okay.
And the other thing is, you know, there are some chilies, if I remember, that are specific to India that might be kind of fun to play with.
Okay.
I know at least there's probably a ton of different spice houses that carry Indian chilies, but I know that I think Penzi's is one. And I want to say one of them is the Dundakut. By the way, I collect chilies. I mean, it's almost embarrassing because if you open my refrigerator, it's obscene what's in there. You know, you can't find the milk, but you're going to find bags of chilies everywhere. But one of the great ways to get incredible flavor from a chili, which you probably know, is, believe it or not, make your own chili powder from the dried whole chili.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, then you know. I'm not telling you anything new. Just throw it in the blender and bam, you've got
right.
it. So, but, you know, you may want to get your hands on some of those Indian chilies. And some of them are as hot as Hades. But there's some variety of flavor to them, which is great. But then again, you can do that with so many different chilies. I would not stay solely with a jalapeno, even though that's fine. But it's so bright and citrusy. And I think you want some velvetiness in there and some fruitiness. To give it some variety. And
okay.
Do you finish your dal? I mean, one of the ways that dals are usually finished, you cook the dried beans or peas with the spices and with seasonings until they're done and it's very soupy and it can be quite thick. But then you fry onion and mustard seed until it pops. And you could fry some of those chilies in that mixture, you know, with fresh ground cumin. And you can do it in ghee, you know, the Indian clarified
right.
butter. And that hot mixture goes on to the dal at the last minute before you serve it.
That does sound good.
Yeah. And in honor of summer, I top that with chopped fresh cilantro and diced raw onion. You know, that combination, it's going to be really sexy.
Yeah, I would love to be able to figure out a cornbread version of naan to serve with it. But...
How about putting corn kernels in naan?
Oh.
Naan's that big freeform bread that you cook on the side of a tandoori oven, but you can also just do it in your oven.
I've done it on my grill with a baking stone, and it's fabulous.
Oh, that's fabulous. That is wonderful. Why don't you put whole grain sweet corn in it?
Yeah.
You know, with some chopped chili and maybe some ajwan seed or some black mustard seed or, you know, a toasted spice of some sort in there, too, so you get a little crunch. Even black pepper. Wouldn't that be cool?
Oh, yeah.
Black pepper and sweet corn and chili? Wow. Hey, Dave, good luck, and let us know, okay?
If I win, I'll definitely send you an email and let you know. So
please do, okay, because we'll be rooting for you.
All right, thank you.
You know, it takes real skill to be daring like this.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
Bye.
Goodbye. Indian food in the summer, please don't even get me started. Mango chunks or peach chunks with lime and chili. Ugh, heaven. A couple of weeks ago, I couldn't hide my envy. Michael Pollan had gotten a tomato named after him. And on the air, well, I just mentioned I was envious. I live for tomatoes. Anyway, we got this incredible email from a guy named Joe. So I'm going to try to get him on the phone. Okay, let's see if he's home. Let's hope so. I'm dying to talk to him.
Hello, this is Joseph.
Hi, Joseph. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper from The Splendid Table.
Hi, how are you?
I am fine. Hey, I had to call you because your email sent me to the moon.
Well, I'm delighted.
Well, you want to do a Lynn Rossetto Casper tomato?
Yes, I think it would be awesome.
All right, so now explain to me what you're doing, because you breed plants, right?
I do breed plants. I mean, right now I'm in graduate school and I'm studying, I'm really focused on ornamental breeding, but
right.
you know, I love food and vegetables, so, you know, I can't help but play with the tomatoes I have in my garden.
All right, so you've got all of these cherry-style tomatoes that you're growing, right?
Right.
Is it a case where each year when you get a plant that you really like, you just save the seeds and then you plant them again?
Well, basically, I mean, I start with two different varieties that had traits that I liked. So I had a cherry tomato that was really, really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also had an heirloom, you know, big, large tomato that had, you know, a more complex, you know, that more interesting, rich, complex flavor. And I wanted to combine those two into one tomato. So I made, cooked the pollen from the one plant, put it on the other plant, and then the seeds from that are different combinations of those two plants. So I'll be tasting all of their grandchildren, actually, to see which ones actually combine, you know, all the traits that I'm most interested in. So what I'd like to do is, you know, ship you a bunch of them so you could taste them and decide which flavor or combination of flavors you really like the best.
Wow, this is good. All right, so you're going to ship out the tomatoes. I'll do a taste, and then you and I will go back and forth about them.
Yeah.
And is it possible that if I like one thing about one tomato and one thing about another tomato, you can make that tomato into one tomato?
Probably. I mean, that's the joy of it, is unexpected stuff comes out. But, yeah, if you think, oh, well, this one has the sweetness I like, or this one has acidity, or, all that kind of stuff, you can combine those to really kind of create the perfect tomato.
Joseph, I have to tell you, I have not met very many other tomato geeks. Thank you so much. I think this is going to be more fun than I have had in years.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm so excited. This is going to be a blast.
This is a privilege. I'm in on groundbreaking science. I love it. Okay, Joseph, we're going to be checking in, okay?
That'd be great.
And thanks so much. Thank you. You have made my summer.
All righty.
Okay. Hey, you take care, and we will talk soon.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye, Joseph.
Bye.
I'm so happy, I'm gonna cry. Well, that's the show for this week. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. You have a great week. And let me leave you with this thought from Laurie Colwin, who said, "A world without tomatoes is like a string quartet without violins." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. But we're going to be back next week. You have a good one, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.